This is Pittsburgh Explainer from 90.5 WESA. Every week we help you understand some of the most important news stories from southwestern Pennsylvania. It's Friday, August 7th. Thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Liz Reed. Danielle Brown hasn't eaten in more than a month, but she says she hasn't breathed in nearly 2 years.
We're in a day and time of Black Lives Matter, and there's a slogan that is constantly being shared, which is, I can't breathe. That's literally this mom. There was an incident that happened to my son, and since October the 4th, 2018, this mom has not been able to breathe.
Brown's son, Marquis Jaylen Brown, died on that day when he fell from the window of his 16th floor dorm room on Duquesne University's campus. The school says he was acting erratically before his death, and investigations by the university and the city of Pittsburgh concluded that he used a chair to break the window and jumped, all while police officers were in the room. Brown says that story doesn't add up.
You had to have been close to him if you're performing de-escalation, crisis intervention, mental health. Truly, you're not performing it from across the room in the doorway. So the fact that he went for a chair, I'm saying, where was the intervention? When he put the momentum to pull the chair back, where was the intervention? When he went to swing the chair and hit the window, where was the intervention? When the window was breaking and the chair never went out the window, where was the intervention? I can't bring him back. I'm not trying to rewrite the narrative. I'm saying there's so many holes and gaps and such a very hard to believe circumstance that it requires this mom to say, it's not good enough for me to accept what you, the school, say.
On Independence Day, she left Washington, D.C., where she lives, and began her hunger strike at Freedom Corner in the Hill District. She's calling for an independent investigation into her son's death to be conducted by her own lawyer. WESA's government and accountability reporter Ariel Worthy has been following her story and joins us now. Ariel, thanks for being on the show this week.
Thanks for having me.
It's now been more than 2 weeks since Duquesne University said it would cooperate with an independent investigation. So what's the status of that investigation?
So according to Duquesne, they are still in cooperation. However, their thing is that they have to go through all of the legal hurdles before they can officially give the information over. I spoke with a representative earlier this week about it, and they said that they still have to follow, you know, federal privacy laws and just make sure that legally they can reveal some information that deals with the case that might be about other people in particular. And they even said, like, you know, these kinds of things, they don't just happen instantaneously. You still have to go through a process.
What has Danielle Brown said in response?
She's frustrated, as you can imagine. You know, she hasn't eaten in over 30 days. And her thing is, they've known about this for a while. They've known about the hunger strike. And she feels that they should have been more prepared. These hurdles should have already been gone through before they publicly announced that they would give in to her demands. Because now she feels that this is just like an extra unnecessary delay. And, you know, this is something she's been asking them about since 2018. So it's not like they were unaware that she's had questions about his death.
Now, you've been visiting Danielle Brown regularly. Can you describe the scene at Freedom Corner?
Yeah, sure. So it started out, it was just her in a white rocking chair and just photos of her son and candles as like a vigil. And now there's like this little tent village. There's about like 4 or 5 tents out there. People stay with her overnight on a regularly every day. She has someone staying with her overnight. They've built just entire community, basically. They have medic people who stay out there with her. They usually kind of rotate shifts, is what I was told. And they just, you know, make sure that she's okay and that there's always someone out there to help her if there's ever any kind of emergency. Usually there's always someone out there, she just visiting her or dropping something off or just checking on her. And that's one thing she said has been really big and key for her, is just having company and having people around her. It's really good that she's like not alone. They've been counting the days. Of course, you know, there's several markers that show that what day it is. They have signs that let people know, you know, once you go into this area, this is like a no food, no alcohol, no drug zone. And when you're in the area, you're there in solidarity with Danielle Brown for the hunger strike. So they ask that you respect those rules that they've set. And yeah, it's kind of different each day. Like on Sunday, they have a drumming circle where people come out and just like play musical instruments and just play music and sing and just all of those things. So each day is a little different.
What has Danielle Brown told you about the kind of person her son was?
When I asked her about him, you could kind of just tell her face just kind of lit up. One thing she did say was that her son was kind of a mama's boy and that they were very close and that.
Which is always the hope for every mom of boys.
But yeah, she said, you know, he was a good kid. He was always like the one who was just like very kind to everyone. He was always just everyone who met him. They always thought he was so nice and just like such a good kid. You know, she said he was a big kid because he was an athlete. He played football at Duquesne, but he wasn't a threatening person. He was a very just helpful, just really kind guy. And that's one thing she wants people to know about her son is not that, you know, his final moments don't define him, but he really was this really good kid. And she said he was a charmer. He had this, she said he had a smile and he was a very big charmer and a lot of girls liked him. So, but when she talks about him, you can tell she's very proud of the son she raised. And that she wants those things to be remembered about him rather than how his life ended.
Ariel, thanks so much for following this story and for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's time for a quick break. We'll be right back.
After months of being cooped up, you might be itching to get back outside. On a nature trail, a quiet stretch of beach, in your backyard, or just walking around your block, take this station with you. We're with you on your phone, your laptop, your smart speaker, or an actual radio. It's easy to stay connected, and the company isn't bad either. NPR, just a tap or a voice command away.
Quote, Black lives simply do not matter to museum leadership. That was the message of an open letter published last week criticizing management of the Children's Museum of Pittsburgh. About 100 current or former museum employees signed the letter. WESA's arts and culture reporter Bill O'Driscoll spoke to 10 of them. Bill, thanks for being here.
Sure.
Can you talk about some of the allegations made in the letter?
What they say is basically, I'm just going to read some of the boldface statements in this letter. An indifference to the children the museum serves, particularly the Black children we serve, an unempathetic and opportunistic attitude toward our staff, partners, and artists, an unwillingness to articulate and protect basic values, and unfair and discriminatory actions against staff. Those are kind of the main headings.
Did the staff members you spoke with give any examples of this?
Sure, there were a number of examples, things like understaffing or attempting to cut programming that primarily served Black children and their families. When the Tree of Life attack happened a couple years ago, a few of the museum employees felt that the way the museum was responding, which had to do with opening the museum for free and sending around a pop-up exhibit about kindness. In other words, their response was all about trying to promote kindness in the community. They felt that that was, the employees, the critics felt that that was kind of inadequate and felt more like marketing than what they felt should have been the response, which was more like a gesture of solidarity with the affected community. And they said that the employees who complained about this, who objected to it, were then retaliated against by being forced outside of their job descriptions to go man these or staff these pop-up exhibits that went around town. In terms of like protecting basic values, one of the things they talked about was the museum apparently doesn't have a real clear policy about if people are wearing hate symbols into the museum. In other words, if visitors wear in something like a Confederate flag or even a swastika, there's no clear way for staff to say that's not allowed in here. Apparently, the museum just handles those things on a case-by-case basis.
And I understand staff alleged that there was an instance where someone wearing a swastika was allowed to move freely about the museum, but someone wearing a Black Lives Matter t-shirt was asked to leave.
Yeah, the t-shirt didn't say Black Lives Matter, but it was something along that theme. The staffer who I spoke to didn't remember exactly what the message was, but it was along that theme. I actually have asked the museum about that, and I'm awaiting a response on that particular incident. But to put this in context, the museum does have a pretty clear policy that if you're wearing, say, a shirt that has a profanity on it or a swear word, you can be asked to turn the shirt inside out or cover it up some way or leave. But they don't have a clear policy about things like Confederate flags or swastikas.
How did the museum leadership respond more generally to the spirit of these allegations?
They responded first that they felt that the letter had a number of false claims and misleading statements. The museum reiterated that it was, quote, extremely proud of its record of serving and partnering with Black and underserved communities, and it remains committed to those principles of diversity, equity, and inclusion.
When we talk about the leadership of the museum, like, who are we talking about? Is there much diversity among this leadership ranks?
There's not a lot, although it should be said that that's probably true of most large cultural institutions in Pittsburgh. The leadership at the Children's Museum, like those other institutions, is overwhelmingly white. Some of the folks have been there for a long time. The executive director at the Children's Museum is Jane Werner. She's been, by many, you know, standards, been very successful. The museum's grown. You know, it serves 300,000 visitors a year. You know, and many of them go away seemingly quite happy with the programming they get there. But I think that the critics, including the folks who signed this open letter, would say we need more diversity at the top in order to better serve these communities that are now underserved and underrepresented.
Is there anything else that these employees are specifically saying they want to see change at the museum?
The letter was written by a former staffer named Will Tolliver Jr., and I should say that he, like dozens of other employees, just saw their jobs eliminated just a couple weeks ago, maybe just a week or so before the letter came out. And some of the response to the letter, including the museum's response, has referenced this as though to suggest that these are simply employees disgruntled about having their jobs eliminated. The people who signed the letter do not all fall into that category, it should be noted. Some of them signed the letter anonymously and still work at the museum. Quite a large number left the museum before the pandemic and the recent furloughs and layoffs and job eliminations. So it doesn't really apply to them broadly. So Will Tolliver wrote this letter, and he also furnished the museum with a list of demands. They include things like hiring more people of color into leadership positions, making diversity and inclusion training regular, that is quarterly and mandatory, and finding some way to quantify the museum's investment in children and families of color by a sort of diversity audit of their finances and spending. You know, this is kind of still in process. The museum seems to be preparing sort of further statements and responses to this this open letter and some of the issues it's raised. So, look for more in the future.
Bill, thanks so much for your reporting.
You're welcome.
It's time for another break. Stay with us.
I'm Dave Isay of StoryCorps. For years, we've connected loved ones through meaningful conversation. At this moment of profound political polarization, we're trying something new. It's called One Small Step. You come to StoryCorps to meet a stranger from across the political divides, not to talk about politics, but to get to know their story. It's an effort to help remind us that we're all just human beings. And WESA is helping lead our effort in Pennsylvania right now. Sign up at WESA.fm.
Last week, the Pittsburgh Public Schools Board of Directors officially decided to go online only for the first 9 weeks of school due to the coronavirus pandemic. Board member Kevin Carter introduced the proposal, saying the health and safety of students, teachers, and staff is on the line. WESA's education reporter Sarah Schneider has been studying the district's plan for remote learning and joins us now. Sarah, thanks for being on Pittsburgh Explainer.
Of course. Thanks, Liz.
Okay, so What is in this plan?
The plan is to continue in many ways what the district was doing when school ended in early June. So students will not be in school buildings for the first 9 weeks. So that's through October. That's if everything works out the way it's supposed to. And I'll explain more on that later. But the plan is for students to be in their own homes, connected to the internet on a district-issued computer or iPad. They will have live instruction every day from their teachers. So that's maybe live demonstrations of physical education or science and arts, you know, the more hands-on subjects. And they'll have access to their teachers throughout the entire day for homework help. The reason I give the caveat of if it goes the way it's supposed to is because there are so many things that need to happen and so many barriers to making this ideal remote learning scenario become reality. Because many parents are still working and need childcare, and teachers themselves are parents and will have to facilitate their own kids' learning. And the district does not have the technology it needs for each student.
I understand that the board just approved the purchase of 7,000 more devices, and another 18,000 are on back order with delivery dates as late as October 20th. What happens if the devices don't arrive in time? School starts August 31st.
First, I will say that it is a huge deal that the district is purchasing these 7,000 more computers, because that means that it will have a device for each student whenever they are delivered. Because as you said, you know, nearly three-fourths of the devices that the district has purchased since schools closed in March are backordered and haven't arrived yet. And the district hasn't given a plan B yet. It will likely distribute more of the work packets it did, like it did in the spring. But parents and teachers both had many issues with those packets not being grade level appropriate or too basic.
And I guess probably just not being as effective a teaching tool for most students as compared to live instruction, right?
Right. It definitely is not individual instruction. It's just teaching every student in the same way. And I wouldn't even say it's instruction. It's a lot of review, the packets were.
What about students who have individualized education plans or have special needs around their learning? How is the district planning to accommodate those students?
So the district says that the main difference will be the technology that students with IEPs, the individualized education plans, can access. So they have that live interaction with their teachers or their therapists. The problem is that at this time of the year, most parents and families have had the plans with their teachers, the plan meetings with their teachers to, you know, determine how the rest of the year is going to go. And I've heard from a lot of parents that those meetings haven't happened yet, and they're concerned that a lot of the same issues that happened in the spring are going to continue into the fall.
Can you help us understand what are some reasons a student might have an IEP?
Yeah, students on the autism spectrum would require special services like speech therapy based on your IEP. So really an IEP is meeting with all of the teachers and stakeholders, which is often the family, and you come together and you make a plan and you decide how we are going to meet the needs of this child throughout the year. And then you have regular check-ins. And so if that's not happening now, you're not set up for success for the rest of the school year if you don't know early on what the specific challenges your student is facing are.
How are parents reacting to this online learning plan?
This is all really confusing, and the information seems to change week to week. And in this country, public education has never been perfect. You know, it was built as an inequitable system. So parents have, at least in the past, though, known what they need to do. You know, you enroll your kid in a school, you send them their daily check in with their teacher and raise concerns with when needed. But now, you know, already stressed out parents have to navigate a completely changed system that many are concerned will more negatively impact their children. And so this week, the group Black Women for a Better Education hosted a virtual town hall, and they heard from two school board members who themselves are Black and represent majority Black schools. And parents are frustrated and asked why suburban districts like, you know, Woodland Hills, which also has a very diverse student body, were able to figure out technology for the district. Because a lot of this, like the IEPs, students with disabilities and the services they require, English language learners, they all of the services that they need require technology. And if the district doesn't have that, they want to know why. And so generally, parents are really frustrated right now. And this group, Black Women for a Better Education, they want a new superintendent. And they said that they plan to run a slate of school board candidates in the 2021 election because they said they want people who will take the concerns about the education of Black children seriously.
Sarah, thanks so much for your reporting this week.
Yeah, thanks, Liz.
That's Pittsburgh Explainer for this week. Our show is produced by Katie Blackley. Christopher Ayers is our editor. You can find all of our news coverage at our website, WESA.FM, and of course, on the air at 90.5 FM. I'm your host, Liz Reed. Thanks for listening. Let's talk next week.